I'm Jane Hart, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the care, protection, guidance of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since May 1st of 1981, and for that I'm really grateful. thanks. Appreciate that. You guys do it upright. I gotta let you know, you do it upright. I mean, and Stephanie really has done right by you, too, because, you know, I received letters, we were in contact, you know, I felt very welcomed in coming here. I got here. You've all been just so welcoming, and it really makes a difference when you can come to a gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter where, and feel that, you know, language of the heart kind of thing, because sometimes you don't always do, and it really makes a difference. And of course, I've had a change of heart, I mean, big time, and it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new to AA, we welcome you big time. And it seems as if when I was new to AA, the thing that I really listened for was, did I drink like you? Was I really alcoholic? And I listened for that. And when I was 2 weeks sober, I came to a gathering like this. It was at Gopher State Roundup in Minneapolis, and there was like 4,000 drunks there. And I'm 2 weeks sober, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking around, and I'm thinking, God, I didn't know there was this many alcoholics in the whole world. It was just amazing that they were all these people are alcoholics. And then the next thing that came to me that really made a difference was, and they didn't seem to mind. It didn't bother them that they were alcoholic. I mean, in fact, they kind of seemed quite happy about it, you know? And it really carried a message to me that, number one, it was going to be okay. It was going to be okay. If you were in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if we're not drinking today, there is always hope, and it's going to be okay. Because there was people who came before me that took me by the hand. You know, they taught me how to go to meetings. They taught me how to not take a drink one day at a time. You know, they taught me how to have a relationship with God. You know, they taught me how to get honest and have some patience and tolerance. You know, that AA was big enough for everybody. You know, they taught me how to have that relationship, that cooperative effort with God that I've never had. You know, they helped me clean up my past. I needed to clean up because I was not clean when I got here, you know. And how to maintain that relationship with God, you know, how to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, they helped me come from the streets, you know, and have the survivalist instinct where, you know, I'm going to rip you off before you rip me off because it's going to happen. I had to let go of that old idea and have spiritual principles come into my life so that I didn't live with that kind of inner conflict, which absolutely demanded relief, and that's why I picked up a drink, because I couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. And a drink always made it better. Well, that was a little roll. Sometimes I get on rolls. You'll just have to excuse me. I got these. I do one of two things when I'm afraid. I either cuss, and we don't want to do that, okay, or I bawl, so I'm kind of a bawler, so... So I'm ready if I do, because I really appreciate my sobriety, and I've received so much, see. I had my first drink when I was 14 years old, and I sobered up at 27, and it was a glass of vodka. Of course, I picture it like this. It probably wasn't, but, you know, we tend to exaggerate. And I downed it because my dad was going to catch me, and I didn't want to be caught, and I slept like a baby. It just seemed like, you know... It seems like 2 years before that, I just knew I was different. I was not like everybody else. And when I took that drink, I got a relief like nothing ever gave me. It just seems as if when I came out of the chute, I was resentful. That was the only thing I really kind of felt. I didn't feel like, you know, love and stuff. I just felt like angry all the time. And when I took that drink, I got relief. And it seems as if from that point on, I lived to have that effect again. And I just always wanted more. I mean, I drank always wanting more. I went under, I went to the point of unconsciousness, to the point of oblivion, going under wanting more. That's how come I know I'm alcoholic. It's because I always wanted more. And I couldn't control my drinking once I took the drink. And the deal about Alcoholics Anonymous is they've given me a way in which I don't need to pick up that first drink. I never knew it was the first drink. I just should have never had that last one. It was always the last drink. It was never the first drink. And AA says, well, don't take the first drink. I was like, you know, that's a very simple concept. You can't get drunk if you don't take the first drink. But I had to be told that. It was like, oh, duh, well, that makes sense. And so by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I lived in Iowa, which was a farming, agriculture state, okay? Now, you probably could tell I fit real well with the farmers, okay? And everything was my problem. I mean, that was my battle cry well into Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? My battle cry was, you know, Iowa was the problem. They were all a bunch of redneck farmers, and a woman wouldn't have a chance, even, you know, not that I would take the opportunity. I was too lazy, you know, but that was one of those deals. Iowa was the problem. They're all a bunch of redneck farmers, and the women baked, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, I was not one who played with dolls growing up. It was like, why would you do that? Why would you play with that? You know, or dishes, you know, why would you play with dishes? That's work. I watched my mother at the sink for years. I was like, you know, I really was kind of a disappointment, really. And you know, now I do my dishes, and, you know, I mean, it's really funny, the change of heart. I mean, I'm a homemaker today. Can you imagine that? I mean, and I enjoy it, and I'm good at it, and, you know. Anyway, Iowa was my problem. My parents were the problem. You know, they were late, you know, raised in the 40s, and I was, this is the, like, 60s and early 70s with, you know, sitar music and, you know, candles over the wine bottles and, you know, peace and love, a lot of free love, you know. I mean, and the big question was you had to get out and get to know yourself, you know, and who am I? And, you know, that was what I was raised with. My parents were the problem. My brothers were the problems. You know, everything else was the problem. I was never the problem. Everything else was. So, of course, I was one who ran. I ran a lot. I mean, I ran in my drinking. I went the coast to coast twice over in my drinking. And so I went out to Southern California at the age of 17. I would have turned 18 that summer. And was in the streets of Southern California. This couple I went out with, he was a Marine recruiter. She kicked me out after being there for a week. Didn't know why. And later I found out that the reason she kicked me out was she thought that I was having an affair with her old man, okay? Now, that was probably the only time, you guys, that I was accused of that was in fact innocent, because that was something I had done. You know, who wanted the whole piece of pie? I didn't want the responsibility. You know, I didn't marry her. You know, you did. It's not mine. I mean, that is how I rationalized and justified what I did. You know, and that's the ism. You know, I can convince myself, in spite of the facts, that sky is green and believe it. And I can, you know, even kind of convince other people that. You know, is it true? No. I couldn't distinguish the true from the false after a while. I thought people who didn't drink were like people who believed in God. They just needed to get out more. You know, I mean, you know, that's how I thought about things. You know, and so she kicked me out. I'm on the streets of Southern California, 17, 18 years old. You know, I was at the mercy of whoever came along. And in the beginning of my drinking, the people who came along were pretty nice people, okay? And at the end of my drinking, you know, they were as sick, if not sicker, than I was, you know, because I sought out sort of places. You know, my alcoholism took me, you guys, to places I didn't necessarily want to go. You know, I was taught better than that. You know, I came from a good family. You know, I came from parents who dedicated their life to creating a home for their children. You know, I was taught right from wrong. You know, but I thumbed my nose at it because I couldn't live up to it. And so it's not as if I didn't know right from wrong, but the more my drinking went on, you know, the more I lowered my lines. What I wouldn't have done, you know, at the first year of my drinking had long gone by the wayside by the time I finally hit bottom. And I just kept lowering my lines and lowering my lines and lowering my lines. And through Alcoholics Anonymous and the change of heart I have, you know, I have some bottom lines today, and I have a conviction to my principles. And what's given me that is my experience. My experience of what works and what doesn't work has given me a conviction. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And there are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, so it isn't anything I've come up with, thank you, God. By the time I was 18 years old, I know that I was beyond recall. And these people that I was hanging out with, they were older than I was. And, you know, I could get along with people older because, you know, my mom had taught my manners well, and I respected my elders. And I could get along with people who were younger because then I could boss them, okay? But I couldn't get along with my peers. And that was something that I had learned well into Alcoholics Anonymous, is how to have a relationship with equals, because I couldn't do that. And the people who were older that I was staying with in Southern California took me out to a bar one night. And, of course, I was a minor. I was in California, and that was a 21-year-old state. And they let me have one drink, and then I was to go home. And I can remember, just like it was yesterday, that I was standing outside that barroom door, and I was pissed. And the reason I was so angry was not because I wanted to spend time with those people, but because I wanted another drink and couldn't get it. So it didn't take me very long. It didn't take me very long before I was drinking and wanted more. Well, you know what? I'll tell you, here I am on the streets of Southern California. My mother's a little worried. She wants me to move up to Sacramento. She has four brothers up there. I did. I partied with a cousin of mine for a month. I wasn't looking for a job. Why? I had a roof over my head. My relatives were feeding me. I mean, it was a free ride. And that's another thing I always did. If I could get you to do something for me, then you know what? You're my best bud. You know, the minute you were done doing for me, you needed to get out of here. I mean, I was a user. I mean, that's what I base all of my relationships on. And it's like, you know what? I didn't have any friends. I wonder why I came to AA. I didn't have to worry about old drinking buddies. I didn't have any. I mean, I had no one, you know. And so by the time I thought, well, okay, this is what I'll do. My uncle pulled me back into his bedroom, and he gave me one of these talks about the simple things in life, okay? And he talked about how, oh, you know, he married his little high school sweetheart, and he had his little house, and he had his little car, and he had his little kids, he had his little job. I mean, he was talking like this was something to have, okay? And I'm thinking, man, you just need to get out more, you know? But, you know, what he was talking about is about the values in life, you know, and doing those things that are ours to do. You know, that's what he was talking to me about. I mean, my parents, before my father had died, enjoyed a marriage of over 40 years. You know, I have those examples, those spiritual examples set for me. You know, but I my rebellion, who wanted it? But he's the one that came up with the idea that perhaps I might want to join the United States Army, okay? I had no idea what I was getting into. I really didn't. All I know is it got me the heck out of where I was at. And that is what I did for years, was just get me the heck out of here. You know, so I joined the Army. I didn't know what it was all about. Went to basic training. You know, and something I learned about that was, you know, I can play the game. You know, you give me the game plan. You know, you give me the rules, okay, and I can play the game. Don't turn your back on me, okay, and don't think I'm being honest about it, but I can play the game. So I got along quite well in the military. I went to basic training. Of course, we couldn't get the booze there, but I went to AIT, which is a military, you know, schooling. Wonderful thing there, you guys. It was EM clubs, booze and men, and I had a ball. I mean, it was just wonderful. But that's where the blackout started setting in. You know, I didn't know how I got back to the barracks. You know, I mean, drinking to the point of unconsciousness, oblivion. You know, and just not knowing what was happening the night before, waking up and having no idea. Well, this is where I met my first husband, okay? Which should have been a clue. And he was from the hills of Fajardo, Puerto Rico. Now, I don't know how he got into the military because he didn't speak very much English. And I kind of knew Ola meant high. You know, I mean, I knew Que Pasa meant what was happening. But, I mean, you kind of know where our communication was. You know, it wasn't, you know, discussions about retirement and children. I mean, it was like, you know, let's go, hubba, hubba, hubba. I mean, you know what I mean? You know what it was. You know what we do. I did that. And so I went to ETS out to Fort Ord, California, and he was a stay in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and we met at the mess hall there, and he said, "You're not leaving." And I think I said, "Oh." And next thing I know, we're getting married, and it had to be a town close to the fort. I mean, I don't know what town it was in. It had to be. Went to the Justice of the Peace. I just remembered here about 5 years ago, I think one of the witnesses' name was Gil. I mean, this is what I remember, okay? And the thing I remember with great clarity is that when the Justice of the Peace said, you know, "I now pronounce you man and wife, and you may kiss the bride," and we kissed, and I bawled like a baby because I just knew I had just made the biggest damn mistake of my life. I knew that. But you don't tell those people that. you tell no one that. Because there's no way I could admit that I was wrong. You know, my pride almost killed me. Because I could not admit I was wrong. And I had everything to prove. And so, you know, I got married to this nut. I mean, it was just a nut. And got pregnant. And, you know, by now the drinking is daily. You know, I mean, I went on out to California and he was still in South Carolina, and don't think I was acting married. You know, that happened back there. You know what? I had no problem when Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to live in the moment. I mean, if it wasn't here, what now, it wasn't happening. I mean, that's just, I mean, I had no problem with that. It's like he showed up and was like, oh yeah, I'm married. You know, it lasts about 7 months. You know, I mean, people who have an idea of what life is all about don't live like that, you know. It's no wonder I had to drink. In 1976, I got out of the military. I came back to the state of Iowa, the thing I said I would never do. But, you know, my daughter needed roots and she needed family, you know, and so I came back the big, noble person I can be. You know, any kind of giving I did, it was never for fun and for free. You know, what I did is I kept tally. I kept tally on an imaginary little card, and I kept it in my back pocket, and it was always there, you know, and you owed me. I mean, that was my, I had a bad attitude, just a bad attitude, you know, and so I moved back to Iowa. In 1976, I was drinking on a bottle of vodka, and I'd kept it in my refrigerator door, and man, you know, I'd been drinking on it all evening. And I went to get it out of the refrigerator, and I opened up the refrigerator door to get the bottle, and I fell to the linoleum floor in my trailer, and I'm flapping around like a fish out of water, okay? And it was really weird, because it was like I knew, I was looking down on me, seeing me flapping around like a fish out of water, okay? And what I did is I got up, and I suppose that was some kind of seizure, I don't know, okay? But I got up, and what I did was I made the next drink. And I really don't think social drinkers drink like that, okay? I really don't. I don't think they do that. And how I handled that, which was another pattern in my way of ism, was that never happened. And the reason it never happened, you guys, is because nobody saw it. And as long as nobody saw it, it didn't really happen. And I lived like that a long time into Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as you didn't see it, as long as I could convince you, okay, then it really wasn't happening. And I was a con. That's what I was. I was a liar. I was a con, you know. That's what I was. And that was in 1976. In 1978, by this time, I have tried, okay, I have tried being a host in Southern California. I have tried being a troop of the United States Army. I have tried marriage, motherhood, and divorce. I have tried, you know, various men, thank you very much. I mean, coast to coast. And I have tried having a job, not having a job. I've tried several things in order to try to make my life manageable. And of course, drinking was never on the list. Drinking was never on the list. And so what I thought in 1978, what I needed was a fine mind. If I could just think. God, if I could just think, I can remember. I don't know if you guys had a throne. I had a throne in my living room. I mean, I had my beer, I had my cigarettes, had my wastebasket so I didn't have to go very far. You know, I had the TV right there. I remember sitting there. I remember sitting there in my throne. And I'm having a beer every 15 minutes. I'm thinking, God, if I could just think, you know? It's like, oh, duh. You know, I can remember my first morning drink. And I would hunker down. This is how I was. I'd hunker down. And I'd hunker down along walls and stuff. I'd hunker down in grocery store lines. I don't know what it was, but that's what I did. And I'd hunker down, and I'd hunker down like this, and I'd hold my cigarette like a joint, okay? And just stare at y'all, you know? I mean, I had a bad attitude. I was hunkered down in this dungeon apartment with silverfish, but, you know, I'm head of my household, you know. I mean, you know how we do that? So I'm hunkered down, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's a beer in my hand. I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's a morning drink. It's was only 10 o'clock in the morning. And the thought that readily supplanted that was, it was Saturday. And Saturday made all the difference in the world. It was perfectly okay to have a morning drink on Saturday. And that's how I just rationalized and justified simply what is the symptom of alcoholism. The drinking is but like a cough to a cold. It's just the symptom of my illness. I couldn't even admit to the symptom. And so in 1978, what I needed was a fine mind because I tried all these other things. So I went, I was going to go to school, okay? Now I have a 2-year-old child at this time, okay, almost 3. The kid didn't have much, believe me, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I had to keep it light. I had to keep it so I could fit everything into a 1964 Comet in 1978, which should tell you something. I got to quit saying that, though, because I got a 4 that's that old now. But anyway, he had to keep it light because you couldn't count on anybody. I mean, I could not trust anybody. I couldn't count on anybody. I had to set up my life so that I could absolutely do it on my own. I mean, because you couldn't count on anybody. And you didn't turn your back on anybody. I mean, you sat in corners against the wall because you got to be able to watch everybody. I mean, that's how I lived my life. Talk about a change of heart. I mean, I was a tough, cold, old, hard broad when I came into AA. I didn't come into AA, you know, thinking, oh, goody, goody, I get to walk in hand with the sunlight of the Spirit. That's not how I came in. I mean, I didn't come in going, oh, thank God I'm home. I mean, I came in pulling a con. That's how I came in. And, you know, so you have to put everything into a 1964 Comet. So here's my two-year-old. She's sitting in the back seat. She's sitting in a car seat, okay? And she has her mattress, her crib mattress over her head, okay? And she's going down to Ankeny, Iowa, so her mother can get a fine mind. It's like, what is wrong with this picture? You know, I can remember when I sobered up. I was probably 3 months sober, and I'd walk into a room and Sarah would jump because I was so unpredictable. She never knew when I was going to be loving or when I was just going to be tearing butt. I mean, she never knew. And I would watch her. And you know what? Her eyes would glass over because that was her defense. She just withdrew. She had to. My daughter saw things before she was 5 years old, you guys, my mother never even thought of. You know, to say that my alcoholism doesn't affect anyone else is a lie. You know, that the only one I'm bothering is me. You know, and the sad, sad thing about that is that when there was supposed to be a bonding going on, there wasn't. Because the bottle had warped me to such a point, I didn't get an overwhelming feeling of maternalistic love when this kid was born. What I got was, I got to take care of business for the next 18 years. So those things that God gives us, like the love a mother has for her child, I was warped. And we have paid for that big time. Alcoholism affects the family. And, you know, we're estranged today. You know, not all of us get our families back. Not all of us make it okay just because we're not drinking. You know, but I'll tell you, we can stay sober in spite of it. One thing I have learned in my sobriety is that my sobriety does not depend upon circumstances or conditions. My sobriety depends upon my willingness to clean house and depend upon God and help others. You know, I'm not going to get it my way. You know, how do I meet that? You know, how do I meet that? And that's what AA has given me. And so we went down to get this fine mind. Well, this is where I met the second something different. I mean, you know, I mean, he was married, which was not different, okay, but he was like 16 years older, and he had a house, which was more than what I had. I mean, I'll do it for a house, you know, that is just how cheap I was. I had no value, you know, I mean, I had no value on things, and, you know, I won the booby prize, they divorced, I moved in with him. I mean, I shacked up with him, okay, it's like that, you know, people who have an idea of what life's about, They have an integrity about them, you know. They have an inner strength about them, you know. They see how their actions affect other people, you know. And I thumbed my nose at those people, But I look at how imaginable, and so I moved into her house. It was her house, you guys. I mean, I was a tart, you know. And of course, that was doomed to fail. But this was in 1979. Then I got picked up for a drunk driving charge and was thrown into jail. Thank God my daughter wasn't with me. And my parents were called at 4 o'clock in Southern California. And as far as I know, no one in my family's ever been in jail. And so it was kind of the beginning of the end, okay, because my cover was being blown. And it was kind of one of these, I knew that they knew, that I knew that they knew, that I knew that they knew, that I might have a small drinking problem if you stretched it and thought about it real hard. I mean, it was kind of the beginning of the end, you know what I mean? Well, through this guy, the second something different, at least somewhere along the way, he'd been involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? And so I went to him. And so I came to AA through a man. I was 13 steps into AA, and so he took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, it was in a little farming community in Nevada, Iowa, with these farmers, okay? And I went there, and I went to my meeting, and, you know, I could admit, the only thing I had no problem with the label alcoholic, okay? I had no problem with that, you know? I was like, I had no problem saying I was an alcoholic. It was just a label, you know? I mean, it was no problem to me. What I couldn't admit was powerlessness. That's what I, you know, even though today I know they're one and the same, for me, that's how I came in, okay? And I went to my little meeting, and what I was doing, you guys, you know, of course, God forbid you wouldn't know something, you know. So, you know, my first 2 years, I'd go to my little, you know, farming community meeting, and I'd go every Tuesday night, and then they'd want to come over to our house for coffee, you know. And I was like, God, I just spent a goddamn hour with you, and here they come. They want coffee at our house, you know. I mean, this is how I came in. And, I'd read every piece of literature AA had to offer. You know, I had read the book, okay, because, I mean, I had read the book. I had held up the book. I opened the book. I thumped the book. I quoted the book. I showed you where you should read it in the book, okay, and to go home and smoke my doobies. And that's what I did for 2 years, okay. Took a first-year chip in Alcoholics Anonymous talking about, oh, how wonderful sobriety is, and, oh, I love you all, you know, and was a month short taking a second-year chip, and I'd hit that bottom. And that bottom for me was I saw myself for who and what I was, and it was no longer anybody else's problems. And what happened to me was I was much impressed with you, okay, because I had lived in a lot of large cities and a lot of large apartment complexes. You know, I didn't have a phone. It's like, why? Why have a phone? I didn't want to talk to anybody. Nobody had any good, and there wasn't any good about anybody or anything. Why have a phone? You know, it's like, who wanted to talk to anybody? They didn't have anything good to say anyway. I mean, watch the news. I mean, I was just cynical and pessimistic. There was no good about anything. I never had a phone. Who wanted one? You know, that's how I was. And when I went to my first meeting of AA and I came back the second week, those people remembered my name. And I couldn't believe they remembered my name. I just couldn't believe that. And I was impressed by that. You know, and it set that example for me that I hope I try and live up to today. When I'm a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I look for the newcomer. You know, and I get up and I go over and I talk to the newcomer, or somebody who's visiting, or somebody who looks like they're new. Now, that's mine to do. That's my job. Somebody did it for me, and it made all the difference in the world. And so I came to these people that I'd been lying to for 2 years, bold-faced lying. And that night, you know, all I knew, you guys, is that you were talking about this prayer and God business, okay? And it's like, I had never even said the word God, unless to cuss, you know. And, you know, so about two, I was to take a trip up to Minneapolis, and for about 2 weeks before I knew I was going to go to my home group to get a new white chip and a new sobriety date. And this guy that I moved in with, I went to him and I said, you know, this is what I want to do. Because I was done. I was so done. I didn't want to live like that anymore. Anything not to live like that anymore. And so I went to him and I said, this is what I would like to do. I would like to go to my home group, and I would like to take a white chip and a new sobriety date. And his response to me was, I wish you wouldn't do that. And the only reason I share that is, if that meant that my kid and I had to live out of my trunk one more goddamn time, so be it. I don't want to drink no more. I don't want to drink anymore. If that meant we didn't have a roof overhead, fine. Because I'm done. I am done. And that's a desire. It's a desire for sobriety. And I want more. I mean, I got a good now. Anyway, so I went to this home group that I'd lied to for about 2 years. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I copped. For an alcoholic to cop, for me to tell the truth about me, I mean, that is a spiritual awakening. For an alcoholic to tell the truth about themselves, I mean, that's a big deal. So I went to these people, and I told them the truth. I told them what I had done. And their response was, you know what, you guys, they got up, they came to me, and they took me in their arms. It was fine. They welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it wasn't any of this throwing stones. Nobody threw a stone so that I could keep coming back. They didn't care. You know, my old-timers, I've had wonderful old-timers in my sobriety. There was a guy named Larry up there, and I went to a step study meeting. It was one of these deals I was mind-screwing with. When did I hit my bottom? Was it when I took my last drink or smoked my last joint? I was just mind-screwing with that. Of course, I pictured Larry standing up just yelling at me. He was like 10 foot. I mean, he's huge, booming voice, big guy. You know, I pictured that. Larry just yelling at me. And I remember driving back to Nevada, and I'm thinking, well, that's cruel and sensitive son of a gun. You know, how could he do that? You know, but it got through to me. You know, it was like, who cared? You know, get honest, get a sponsor, work the steps. You know, and thank God, because the reason I took a white chip was in the name of honesty. That's why I took it. And I got a sponsor. Her name was Sheila. Wonderful woman. This woman had the patience of Job. She's passed away. But, you know, she's part of my legacy. If it hadn't been for Sheila, I wouldn't be there. And, you know, I worked the steps as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with my sponsor. That's where I worked it. And, of course, I married the second something different. I mean, we don't get well here. I mean, I married him on my first year anniversary date just so nobody could say anything. I mean, I was still playing that, you know. You know, just under the wire so nobody could say anything instead of having the humility of doing it somebody else's way. And so that was doomed to fail. When I got at 2 years sober, you know, and the reason I share this is because I didn't just come in here and get well. It was a process. It still is a process. And when I was 2 years sober, you guys, I saw this marriage failing. And I didn't want it to fail because, of course, it was my will to be married to this guy. And so what we got into was Harley-Davidson Sportsters. Now, if you're a Harley-Davidson Sportster rider, I love you, okay? I mean, this is just where I was coming at. And so here I was, 2 years sober. I had the butch haircut, okay? I had the black goggles. I had the black shorty gloves. I had the three-partition black billfold with a chain in the hip pocket attached to my belt. I had a T-tank on with no bra. I mean, no bra. Across my chest, genuine Harleys and Davidson parts. I had jeans on that did not know what underwear was, okay, with boots on, rain in them and on them. And I had a brand new Harley Davidson XLX Sportster, 510 pounds, dry, you know, dry shorty duals, V-twin engine, very nice bike, okay? And I'm running around to AA meetings talking about how hard it is to be humble when you have a Harley Davidson. You know, I was going to places in my sobriety where, you know, women had to show their private parts in order to get admission. And we went down to this biker rally. I was 2 years sober, you know, and I'm a prude. It just seems like those of us who are the most wild in our drinking really become the most prudish in our sobriety because, man, I'm a modest person. I mean, you know. Well, go to this biker rally, and there's these people, and I'm looking at them, and they're riding their bikes, and they don't have any clothes on. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, these people don't have any clothes on. And I wasn't there 15 minutes before. I'm thinking, well, I wonder if I can ride my bike with no clothes on. You know? You know how we think? I become like who I hang with. I do. I wish I had more fortitude. I wish I had better character. I wish I had a stronger relationship with God, whatever. All I know is that I become like who I hang with. And so I have made the conscious decision to hang with the winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't hang with the losers. I hang with the winners. And the winners to me are the people who participate and are in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what I do for my sobriety. I go to 3, probably 4 meetings a week without fail. My home group is the Fox Hall Chapter 7 group. It meets in Hopkins, Minnesota, Highway 169 and 7, 7:30. And I'll tell you, that's where I am at without fail. That's where I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group. I sponsor gals. I have a sponsor, thank you very much, who is more active than I am. And I want what she has. You bet your butt I want what she has. And, you know, I try to emulate her. I do what those people who have come before me do. You know, because I want to stay sober in the long haul. You know, I want to stay sober. And, you know, I'm intergroup service rep, you know, for my home group. You know, and I try to be helpful wherever I can be because that's mine to do. And, you know, when I was 6 years sober, you guys, of course that marriage failed. You know, Harley's wasn't a good bond. And you know, when I was 6 years sober, my second sponsor moved away. You know, and I went without a sponsor for a couple of years, from 4 to 6.5 years. And I got crispy, critter, arid, desert, dry. Dry, 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 dry. I mean, I was yelling at the kid again. You know, my boss was just damn lucky I was showing up every day. And besides, I could do her job better anyway, you know. I mean, you know, I was starting to hit and miss meetings, you know. I was a treasurer for one group, and I know I'm not the only one who's done this. But, you know, I mean, I was a treasurer for this little group on Wednesday night. And I would go, I'd count the money, I'd record the money in my calendar, go home and put it in my teapot. Well, it was ready cash. I was stealing from a group of Alcoholics Anonymous as their treasure. And by the time I was done, I owed that group $145. And that was one of those 6 secrets I didn't want anybody to find out about. Okay, I had this 6-week fling I might as well had gone to the bar for. It was just that degrading and that dirty. The only thing I had left, okay, this pigeon was going to come over. I locked the doors. I shut the curtains. I wasn't going to let her in because I didn't want to hear it. Okay, and picture that. The only thing I needed in order to make that picture complete was a beer in my hand. That was the only thing I had left to do to make that picture. And I was 6 years sober without a drink. Drinking is but a symptom. I mean, I was suffering from alcoholism big time. Well, I thought, well, that's chicken, you know what? So I flipped on the lights, opened the door, let her come in. And when we're really, really sick, okay, they start in on this stuff that makes you want to puke about all the stuff you have to be grateful for, okay? And she goes, well, now, Jane, you know, you have your little trailer, you have your little car, Sarah loves you, we love you, you're sober. And what came out of my mouth, the thing that I couldn't buy anymore, it was no longer whether you bought it. I couldn't buy it. What came out of my mouth was, screw God and screw AA. And I could not buy that. I couldn't buy it. A had given me too much. Everything good in my life was a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't buy it. But it was a small indication that perhaps I might be in trouble. Okay? And so this couple came out and put on a sponsorship workshop, and I went to listen as only the dying can be. And so I went to take his inventory. I mean, you know, because I'd heard about him before, you know. And this woman talked, and it was like, I wanted her to be my sponsor. I wanted that woman specifically to be my sponsor. And, of course, I was going to ask her to be my sponsor, and so I slid and called her 2 weeks later, and this pigeon of mine said, you know, I think you better call that woman and ask her to be your sponsor. You know, I mean, you know, I did not get real well real quick or real willing. You know, so I called her, and I was so afraid she'd say no. God, I was afraid of that. And she didn't say no. She said yes. And she didn't have very much to say. I mean, I was taking everybody's inventory, you guys. I was taking groups' inventories. I was taking states' inventories. I was taking districts' inventories. I was taking your inventory. I was inventorying my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not going to stick at 6 years. We hear about that. The time between the 5th and the 10th year, we lose a lot of people, and I was not going to stick. So the second time I called her, she had plenty to say. Boy, I'll tell you, She said, okay, Jane, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to three, preferably four meetings a week. One of those is to be a speaker meeting, because the only one you've been listening to for so damn long is yourself, and it's high time you start listening to somebody else for a change. She said, I want you to read the third step out of the 12 by 12 for 30 days. She said, I want you to write a long letter about yourself to me. And the fifth thing that she asked me to do was, and I want you to wear a dress and a skirt to dress and a heels to at least one meeting a week and act like a lady. Of course, I'm writing all this down, you know. And I said, okay, Peggy, this is what you want me to do, okay? You want me to do this and this and this and this and this, and you want me to wear a skirt and heels to one meeting a week and act like a goddamn lady. And she said, that's right. I hung up that phone. I said, obviously this woman does not know who I am. You know, it's like, you know, where's that say that in the book? Not even in the stories or anything does it say anything about that, you know? Well, you know, I'll tell you, what came to me that was not of me was, I need to change. I need to change big time, you know? And if that meant, you know, I am not going to let anything stand in the way of taking the actions that my sponsor asked me to do, because I need help in changing. I don't have the power to live by these principles. If I had the power to live by these principles, I'd live by them. You know, I don't. And I needed that accountability in my life, that woman in my life that I am willing to tip my hat to, somebody to respect, because I didn't respect anybody. I didn't respect anything. You know, in order to respect something, in order to serve something, I have to respect it. And I needed to be taught those actions that are respectful. Because I was on such the fringes of society that I needed to be taught that. You know, and it's like my sponsor is 35 years sober. And she is more active than I am. I want to be like her. I want, you know, and in taking direction, it was like, you know, the newcomer, their world's about this big, okay? You know, my world's about like this. You know, I can see their world, but my sponsor's world is like this. I want that perspective. I want that wisdom. I want to better be able to help the newcomer. You know, I want her sense of humor. She can laugh at herself. She has a good time no matter where she goes. She's not filled with a bunch of self-doubt and feeling like they're inadequate. You know, another thing is, I'm really glad my old-timers called it for what it is. They didn't say I was depressed. They said I was full of self-pity. That's what they told me. It was like, you know, I'm so grateful for that. No, they didn't say, oh, you're having a panic attack. They said, you are so full of self-centered fear, the only one you're thinking about is yourself. I mean, I am so grateful for that. They didn't talk to me about self-esteem. They talked, you know, that's in the third column. You know, there's plenty of wrong with me, you know, and it starts with self, you know, self-esteem. I can't be worried about myself. I had to earn my respect back. I had to earn my self-respect back. And how I did that was the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 8 years sober, and I'll wrap this up, when I was 8 years sober, after that second husband, we had a big price to pay for that relationship, a big price. And the price had gotten too high to do it one more time. And if that meant that I had to be celibate for the rest of my life, so be it, because I was done. And so I commenced to do all those things I should have been doing all along anyway. Like mowing my yard and doing my dishes and going to work and paying the bills. You know, that was mine to do all along. And I started doing that. You know, I started, you know, being a mother. You know, I started, you know, doing those things. And when I was, Jim, I love Jim, okay? He sobered up with me. We sobered up in the same area. We were peers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, he went out and he got married and he got his sick experience. I got my sick experience. And we were just friends. That's all we were. We're friends, okay? And he'd show up maybe once a year, and he'd take me out to dinner, you know. But it was no big deal. It was just Jim. You know what I mean? When we were 8 years sober, he came back into the area, and he took me out to dinner. It was this really nice Chinese place. And I'm thinking, no big deal. Well, my parents are there, and my 14-year-old kid is there by this time. And I just had this need to announce, this is not a date. And the 14-year-old looked at me, and she goes, well, it sure looks like one to me. So we go out to this Chinese restaurant. We're sitting there, we're eating our food. I mean, it's just Jim. It's no big deal. It's just Jim, okay? And I see this woman in the program. I start thinking, well, I wonder if she thinks this is a date. You know, and all this stuff. I was like, oh, my God, what am I doing? This is Jim. What am I? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, all this mind screwing started going on, and I called my sponsor. I said, what am I doing here? And she said to me, she said, well, it sounds as if your feelings towards him are changing. And you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, I told no one. No one knew that. No one. Jim, no way. I mean, he's a goof. I'm a bitch. What do we got in common? You know what I mean? I mean, really. I mean, we were both into the spectrum, okay? And Peggy made me date him for 2 years. 2 years I was to date him. At the end of a year, I didn't care if I ever saw him again. I mean, it was like, you know, you're a nice guy, you know, later, you know. But I heard a little, 2 years, I got a date, so I had another year to go. If she would have given me 6 months, no problem. If she would have given me a year, I would have taken a bit in the teeth. But she gave me 2 years, which completely took it out of my hands. And I would have ended it at a year. Well, we got married December 21st, 1991. And he is the love of my life. He is just the love of my life. It's like, you know, I didn't know what you guys were talking about. I had no idea. I thought that people who couldn't, like these people who couldn't even separate for the weekend, it was like, oh, God, you need to get a life. You know, Jesus, man. You know, it never even dawned on me. I remember when Jim went off on training on a plane somewhere. No big deal. Just going to take Jim, drop him off the airport. You know, no, didn't even think about it. Knew he was going. No big deal. Went in the airport, was going to say goodbye to him, went to kiss him, and there was little tears in my eyes. Never dawned on me that people like to spend time together. It just never even dawned on me. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know until I knew it. And I've had a change of heart. I have been touched. My heart was so cold and so bitter and so hard. You know, and today it's like I am touched at such a level that I can't even begin to tell. It's beyond words. I love the people. I love my sponsor. I love my husband. I love my pigeons. I love Alcoholics Anonymous to such a point I can't even begin to express it. But God knows. God knows. And my spirituality started, how they started with me was, I was to start appreciating. I was to start appreciating things. And any day that I put my head on my pillow and I haven't taken a drink that day, I can call it success. And of course, I want a deeper relationship with God. You know, I want that. But I am not the fellowship's more religious members. You know, mine is more action-oriented. But I see God everywhere. And one more thing, and then I'll shut up. You know, they talked about dreams coming true. And I would listen to that in AA, and I'd go, you know, that's nice for you. I'm really happy for you. But I had no dreams. People like me don't have dreams. Why? That's always my battle cry. Why? Well, I have a dream coming true. Next week, I'm getting a little Arab mare. I have not ridden since I was a teenager. It was one of those things I thought I had used up and could never get again. And I have a dream coming true. You know, I have a dream coming true for me. And it's really bad because, not bad, but you know, whether it's good times or bad times, I have to stay in my moment. This horse is going to be has been coming for the last 3-4 months. I mean, I've been missing like turns. I've been driving not realizing I just drove. I mean, I go off. Never fantasize really much, but I have about this. And it's like I had to keep where my hands are at. You know, I had to keep in my day. You know, because whether times are good or times are bad, you know, there's things for me to do, and I have to stay in the moment. And that's where I find my God. It's in the moment. So anyway, I know I've kind of rambled a little bit, but, you know, I am so grateful for my sobriety. And if you're new, and you're kind of wanting to puke at that, that's okay, because we're glad you're sober, and someday you're going to be as happy about it as we are. And just keep coming back, because there is not a person in this room that if you're wanting to stay sober, they will go to bat for you to help you do that. So just please keep coming back, and thanks a lot for having me come and share.